Okay, a lot of what I'm talking about will be is covered in these papers here. And of course, we know the knowledge of the neutrino mass matrix is essential for understanding the nature of neutrino mass, where it might come from, and also whether or not we have leptonic CP violation. And currently, as we've heard, there are two unknown parameters in the neutrino mixing matrix. And what I'll be talking about mostly is how we can devise or perhaps experimental strategies to actually make a unique determination of the neutrino masses and mixings. And in my talk, I'll just be assuming three neutrinos. And as we've seen, two of the mixing angles have already been fairly well determined, along with two of the mass squared differences. And in this case, for this mass squared difference, the actual sign has been determined, apparently, from the solar neutrino experiments. And in the atmospheric experiments, only the magnitude of the mass squared difference is determined. And here's the two parameters that are not constrained yet, or at least not determined yet, theta 1-3 and delta. And of course, there's currently an upper limit on the size of this, but no information on the CP phase delta yet. And in the future, long baseline experiments will provide better measurements here, and hopefully will give us our first measurements of these unknown parameters. And including the long baseline experiments can also, in principle, determine the whether this is positive or negative. And CP violation is very important. And in neutrino oscillations, it manifests itself as a difference between the neutrino and the antineutrino oscillation probability. In a vacuum, that would give you intrinsic CP violation. However, matter affects the neutrino and the antineutrino propagation differently. And so, in fact, you can get a difference between these two probabilities even if there's no intrinsic CPV, just from matter effects. And what the matter effects depend upon the mass splittings. If you have the usual hierarchy, the neutrino probability is enhanced. And if you have the inverted hierarchy, the antineutrino probability is enhanced. And so this means that the detection of CP violation is not easy because you have these matter effects to disentangle. However, it also means you can use the matter effect to actually determine the mass ordering. And another important point is that both the intrinsic CPV and the matter effects require a non-zero theta 1-3 in order to detect them. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about how you measure CP violation in a long baseline experiment. And you can write approximate expressions for the oscillations in matter, and I'm not showing the detailed formulas, but just the gist of what they look like. And so here's the oscillation probability for neutrinos and antineutrinos from mu mu to mu e, and they have terms that depend on the CP phase. They depend on the oscillation argument delta, which goes like delta m squared L over e. And there's different expressions for positive delta m squared and negative delta m squared, and that's the matter effect. And these coefficients here I haven't written out in detail, but they depend on the neutrino mixing angles, and they increase as theta 1-3 increases. And the B and C coefficients are enhanced in matter, and the B bar and C bar are suppressed in matter. And you can see where the CP violation comes into play. The intrinsic CP violation comes from the sine delta term here, which has the opposite sign between neutrinos and antineutrinos. And the matter-induced CP violation comes from the fact that these coefficients are different from the barred coefficients. So you have unbarred coefficients for neutrinos and barred for antineutrinos here, for example. And that's the matter effect of CPV. Now, if you want to measure these two parameters, theta 1-3 and delta, the straightforward way is to measure a neutrino probability and an antineutrino probability at, for example, one distance and neutrino energy, for instance, with a conventional narrowband neutrino beam. And from that, you've made two measurements, and in principle, then you can determine the two unknowns, theta 1-3 and delta, with those two measurements. However, the problem is that there are three possible two-fold parameter degeneracies that gives you non-unique solutions for theta 1-3 and delta. And in fact, they can mix CP-conserving and CP-violating solutions, as we'll see here. So these are the three possible parameter degeneracies. And the best way to see these, I think, is to fix the value of theta 1-3 and plot the neutrino probability versus the antineutrino probability as the CP phase varies, and that gives you an ellipse in this probability space. Now, the first ambiguity is the delta theta 1-3 ambiguity. And what happens is if you have
ellipses for different values of theta 1-3, they will overlap in this parameter space as you vary the value of delta. And here's an example of sine squared 2 theta 1-3 equals 0.01 and 0.003. And they overlap at, say, this point here, which is a value of delta equals 0 for this one, and close to 3 pi over 2 for this one. And so we can see that the values of theta 1-3 can be very different for these two different ellipses, and they can also have very different values of delta. In fact, you can have a very large confusion between CP violation in this case and CP conservation in this case. And yet they give the same set of data points in this probability space. And so that's the delta theta 1-3 ambiguity. So there's a very large ambiguity in the values of these two parameters. The second ambiguity is the sine of delta m squared, whether it's positive or negative. And the ellipses here are shifted. The positive delta m squared ellipse shifts towards the probability axis, the neutrino probability axis, and the negative delta m squared ellipse shifts towards the antineutrino probability axis. However, you can have these two different ellipses overlapping once again, and you can have once again different values of theta 1-3 for the same point in probability space. Here, however, the theta 1-3 values are somewhat closer, generally speaking, than they necessarily are here. However, you can still have a large confusion between CP violation and CP conservation. Here you have delta equals 0 on this ellipse, and clearly something is very far from a CP conserving case for the other ellipse. And the third ambiguity is in the value of theta 2-3. And basically, the atmospheric neutrino experiments only measure sine squared 2 theta 1-3. And so that means there's actually two solutions possible, theta 2-3 less than pi over 4 or greater than pi over 4. And once again, for each of those two solutions, you can do this, draw these ellipses. And ellipses with different values of theta 1-3 can once again overlap and give the same points in this probability space. And here, theta 1-3 and its alternate solution can be very different. In this case, they differ by an order of magnitude. And once again, there's a large possible confusion between CP violation and CP conservation. Here, delta equals 0 is clearly overlapping something that's not CP conserving. Anyway, so when taken together, you have three different two-fold ambiguities. And so in general, it's possible to have as much as an eight-fold degeneracy, which means eight different solutions for the same two measurements. And in each case, you can have a large confusion between CP violation and CP conservation. Now, so the task is to try to decide how to best get around these problems. And the first thing you can do to try to reduce the effects of these ambiguities is that you can sit with the oscillation argument equal to an odd multiple of pi over 2. This is the peak of the leading term of the vacuum oscillation. And in fact, it's also close to the peak in when the oscillation is in matter. This actually eliminates the cosine delta term in that approximate probability expression. So you only have a sine delta term. And then the ellipses that I was drawing earlier actually collapse to lines in your probability space. And it looks something like this. And for the three different ambiguities, then you have this situation. Here for the delta theta 1-3 ambiguity, here are your now lines in probability space. And in fact, theta 1-3 is removed from this degeneracy in that each value of theta 1-3 has a distinct non-overlapping set of lines here. Now, there is a residual delta pi minus delta ambiguity. And that just comes about because all you're measuring now is sine delta. And so you can't distinguish, say, between delta equals 0 and delta equals pi. And another nice feature here is that there's no confusion between CP violating solutions and CP conserving solutions, because the two CP conserving solutions overlap each other. And they actually form a line as theta 1-3 varies along here. And then the CP violating solutions are either over here or over here, separate from the CP conserving solutions. So that's the first ambiguity. The second ambiguity is with the mass ordering, sine delta m squared. And here you can have, here's two different, one for positive delta m squared, another for negative delta m squared. And here you can have an overlapping of these two solutions. The theta 1-3 uncertainty is still there, although it's somewhat smaller. Here it's sine squared 2 theta 1-3 is 0.01. Here it's not much different than 0.01. So you get a fairly, even if you don't know which curve you're on, you still get a fairly good measure of theta-1-3. However, there's still a possible large confusion between CP violation and CP conservation. In particular here, the CP conserving values on the solid curve are in the same point basically as the maximal CP violation on the dashed curve. Now, if you're lucky and you're sitting out here at this end, or maybe this end, then you're not in the overlapping region and you don't have this ambiguity. But that only occurs if you're lucky enough to be in this part of parameter space, or and also assuming your experimental errors are not too large. Okay, the third ambiguity is theta-2-3. And here you can take those approximate expressions I talked about and show at least a leading order that the two different values of theta-1-3 differ by a tangent squared theta-2-3. Which can actually be as much, this can be as much as a factor of two difference between these two for sine squared 2 theta 2-3 at 0.9 or greater. And so you might get two different solutions here whose sine squared 2 theta 1-3 differ by a factor of two, and yet they're still landing in more or less the same place in probability space. The nice feature here is that the CP violating and CP conserving confusion is small because all of the CP conserving solutions sort of cluster close to each other here. And the other thing is that, of course, if theta-2-3 is equal to pi over 4, which is the favored experimental value, then this ambiguity goes away, and you don't have to worry about it. Okay, so anyway, sitting on the peak does some nice things for you. Well, first of all, for the first two ambiguities, theta-1-3 is fairly well determined. Here, it's no longer part of the degeneracy, and here, it's part of it, but it doesn't really vary very much. And for this one and this one, the CP violation versus CP conservation confusion is basically taken care of. So the only things that are left are the large CPV, CPC confusion that occurs because of this degeneracy. And then maybe if theta-2-3 is not equal to pi over 4, you might have a theta-1-3 problem with two different solutions here. Now hopefully, if the favored value is correct, then you don't have to worry about this one. And so what's left to take care of here, perhaps, is the is this problem here between these two different solutions from the sine delta m squared ambiguity. And then finally, another thing that's left is this residual delta pi minus delta ambiguity. However, this even though you may have this ambiguity, you still know the size of the CP violation, even if you don't know the exact value of delta. So there's sort of two solutions with the same size of CP violation. Okay, so as I mentioned, there's still the sine delta m squared ambiguity, but there's a way to get around that also. And that is if you choose your oscillation argument at the peak again, but now you go to longer L, so you get larger matter effects. And basically, the regions for the positive delta m squared and negative delta m squared solutions split apart because of the larger matter effects. And this shows how as you increase the distance from 1290 to 1770 to 2600 kilometers, you can see how the two different regions are splitting apart further and further due to the larger matter effect. And so if you're, say, in one of these regions and theta-1-3 is not too small, then you'll know if you're sitting here versus sitting over here. And so you'll know the sine of delta m squared, and then you no longer have the CP violation or CP conservation confusion that you might have if these were overlapping. Okay, so you need a large enough L so that these are split apart. Then you have small confusion here. There's still a residual delta, pi minus delta ambiguity, because all you're measuring is sine delta. And there still might be a problem with theta-1-3, but theta-1-3 is uniquely determined if theta-2-3 is at the preferred value of pi over 4. Okay, so that does a fairly good job of pinning down the parameters. But we still have that one remaining ambiguity of perhaps delta and pi minus delta. And so I want to talk a little bit about how to get rid of all the ambiguities, in principle at least, and what it takes to do that. And you might think, well, maybe if you made two different measurements instead of the two that I've been choosing, maybe you could maybe handle these ambiguities in a better fashion. Anyway, it turns out you can make some sort of general statements And just in general, if you just make one a neutrino and one antineutrino measurement, just mathematically you can show using those approximate probability formulas that those degeneracies exist over wide areas of the delta theta 1-3 parameter space, no matter what you do. And in fact, you need additional measurements to eliminate these degeneracies. And it turns out that a third measurement you can show reduces the region where degeneracies occur to lines in the delta theta 1-3 plane. And then a fourth measurement then reduces the degeneracies to isolated points in your parameter space. And then, in fact, a fifth measurement would, in principle, remove all of them. And just as an example of what I mean by this, let's say you make a neutrino and antineutrino measurement on the peak, and then the degeneracies are possible if your parameters delta and theta 1-3 lie anywhere between the solid lines here. This is for just L equals 300 kilometers. Now, if you add another measurement, one neutrino measurement at a different value of the oscillation parameter, either changing L or E, well, in this case, changing E, then the degeneracies only occur along the dashed curves, this the one-dimensional region here and here. And then if you add a fourth measurement, say an antineutrino measurement at this value of the oscillation argument, then the degeneracies only occur at these particular isolated points in the parameter space. So each time you add a measurement, you reduce the dimensionality of the region where possible degeneracies can occur. Now, of course, obviously, we want to probe especially this region and maybe even below. So obviously, two measurements are going to have a problem. And even three measurements, which has degeneracies along the dashed curve, run up into the region where you definitely want to probe. However, once you start pushing down to these points, if you can push these points far enough to the left, then you don't necessarily have to get rid of them completely. You just have to push them out of the region where your experiment is sensitive. Now, that example is just at 300 kilometers. If you make measurements at longer distance, you actually it helps reduce the degeneracies, or at least push them to lower values of theta 1-3. And here, basically, the larger matter effects are helping you to resolve some of these degeneracies. So here, this is assuming four measurements, two neutrino and two antineutrino. And in one case, with the pluses, they're done at 300 kilometers. And then as you increase the distance at which these four measurements are made, you notice how the degeneracies are pushed to smaller and smaller values of theta 1-3. And so the longer distance helps push them kind of out of the way, under the rug, where you don't have a problem with them. And another point is that measurements at different L can also help reduce degeneracies. I think it's because basically the different matter effects help resolve the sign of the delta M squared ambiguity, which comes in with a matter effect. In fact, we found that two measurements at one distance and one measurement at a second distance actually push the degeneracies to a lower value of theta 1-3 than four individual measurements at a single L. So having different distances helped. Okay, so how might you want to put this in practice? Okay, well, I've been talking mainly here about making individual measurements at particular energies, and so an off-axis beam is a good way of getting a narrow energy spectrum for your neutrino beam. And off-axis beam also have other nice features, such as a smaller beam contamination. They also have a suppression of the high-energy tail, which leads to lower backgrounds in your detector. And also, one beam has a lot of flexibility in the distance and energy of the neutrino. For instance, a beam starting at Fermilab aimed at Sudan, which is 735 kilometers, if you go 1 degree off axis of that beam, the beam will exit the Earth anywhere from 510 kilometers on the near side out to 960 kilometers on the far side. So you get a wide range of possibilities just for one beam tunnel. And the neutrino energy falls off as you go further off axis. And also, because the energy falls off, the flux also falls off, and so that puts a practical limit as to how far off axis you can go. And another nice feature here is there's a possibility, since you can put maybe detectors at different positions for the same beam running simultaneously, you might be able to have multiple detectors as well. Okay, so we did a simulation just to see how this might work. And so we took two different experiments, the JHF to Super-K experiment with a 2-degree off-axis beam, and Fermilab aimed at Sudan. And for this one, we assumed that the fluxes were, the beam powers were upgraded beyond their initial values, and we assumed 2 years running of neutrino, 6 years of anti-neutrino here, which gives roughly similar numbers of events in the two channels. Here, L and E are chosen to be roughly near the peak, and we just took the usual super-K size here for the detector. And for the Fermilab beam, we also assume the upgraded version here. Once again, equal numbers of neutrino and anti-neutrino events. And the off-axis angle we let float, and which allowed us to vary the L and E values. And here we assumed a 20 kiloton detector. And we threw in backgrounds of 0.5% of the unoscillated charge current rate, and we assumed the backgrounds were known to 5%. And so the question we asked was, what is the best off-axis angle for the Fermilab detector, which then gives you an L and E, when used in conjunction with the JHF detector? So we're going to combine the results of both experiments. And the key questions are, can you resolve the sine of delta M squared ambiguity? How well can you do in measuring CP violation? And can this other ambiguity, how well can it be resolved? Now for our analysis, we assume this set of parameters down here. This one's a little out of date, but I'll talk about what to do with the actual value of 7 times 10 to the minus 5. Okay, so first of all, you want to have a decent signal, and you want to have a good ability just to measure sine squared 2 theta 1 3. And so this is just the basic discovery reach in just the neutrino channel alone for the NUMMI beam. And this is the 3 sigma sine squared 2 theta 1 3 reach for discovery. And this is the space of where the detector can be. So this is the off-axis angle, and then this is between the two solid lines here is the range of distances you can have for that off-axis angle. And this shows you the reach in sine squared 2 theta 1 3. The best you can do is about 0.003 or a little bit better in this region here. And the boxes here are just the position of the first peak of the oscillation just for reference. And so you can get down to about 0.003 in the best case. And this is actually just assuming the NUMMI neutrino beam. If you add in the statistics of JHF plus the anti-neutrino beams, of course this would be improved. Okay, well the first question we wanted to ask was, what about the sine of delta M squared? And so this shows how low in theta 1, 3 you can go to make a 3 sigma to distinguish the sines of delta M squared at 3 sigma. Once again, using the NUMMI and JHF, neutrino and anti-neutrino information, that's 4 measurements. And we notice the two distances, even though both of these are fairly modest distances, using them in combination allows you to actually make a sine squared or sine of delta M squared determination for sine squared 2 theta 1 3 as low as about 0.03, which is in this region here. Off-axis angle about 0.7 to 1 degree and a distance of around 900 kilometers. And here the longer distances for the NUMMI detector is better. You do better as you increase your L. And that's just because you get a larger matter effect. Okay, another question was the CP violation sensitivity. And so here, this is the how low in theta 1, 3 can you go for resolving delta equals 90 from delta equals 0 at the 3 sigma level. Once again, using the 4 measurements here. And the best sensitivity occurred in this region. And you could get down for sine squared 2 theta 1 3 as low as 0.01. You could distinguish between maximal and zero CP violation. And once again, longer L is somewhat preferred, although maybe not as strongly as in the previous case. And the last question was, what about resolving this ambiguity between delta and pi minus delta? Well, here, you need some cosine delta dependence in order to resolve this. And so you cannot be on the peak because the cosine delta term goes away on the peak. So you have to be off peak in order to do well here. And you can see that this region here and this region here did the best, although it didn't really do all that well. Certainly not as well as in the previous two cases. Also, this is just a 2 sigma reach, or the reach for doing this at 2 sigma. Nowhere in this plane could you actually distinguish between these two at 3 sigma. So this was a much harder thing to do. And also, it's at odds with the other measurements. which tended to be best somewhere near the peak of the oscillation, whereas this, you couldn't do at all on the peak of the oscillation. Okay, well, so what might be the best thing to do? One possibility, it provides a good compromise between doing the sine of delta m squared and CP violation, and that is to do the JHF experiment as planned, and then do the NUMMI experiment with an off-axis beam, maybe 0.7 to 0.8 degrees at about 900 kilometers. And this puts both of those measurements on the peak, and of course then you won't be able to do the delta pi minus delta ambiguity, but hopefully you can do the sine of delta m squared and also something with CP violation. Now, these are the same experimental parameters for NUMMI as were discussed in this paper, which was maximized for theta-1-3 and CPV sensitivity, and we found that this position was also good for determining the sine of delta m squared when you combine the NUMMI data with the JHF data. Okay, now a little comment about the sensitivity of these things to the solar delta m squared. Now, if you just do a measurements, say neutrino and antineutrino measurements with NUMMI alone, the ability to determine the sine of delta m squared is very sensitive to the size of the solar mass scale. And that's shown here on the right plot. This is with NUMMI, neutrino, and antineutrino measurements only. You can see that how low in theta-1-3 you can go and still determine the sine of delta m squared is very dependent on the size of delta m squared 2-1, the solar scale. So the sort of preferred region is here in orange, and you can see that as you go to the high end of the preferred region, you're losing all sensitivity completely, and if it happens to be up at 2 times 10 to the minus 4, which is still possible, it's way off here where it's already been excluded. However, if you make two measurements, at say at JHF, and then two measurements at NUMMI, the sensitivity to the solar mass scale of this sine delta m squared determination is decreased quite a bit. In fact, there's almost no difference in your sensitivity whether sine of delta m squared, or well, delta m squared 2-1 is either 5 times 10 to the minus 5, 1 times 10 to the minus 4, or even 2 times 10 to the minus 4. It doesn't really change your sensitivity to determining the mass ordering. So two measurements at different L helps reduce your sensitivity to the solar mass scale.
I mean, there's a big deal there at the very end. You go to very large solar delta m squares, and Campbell can't measure it anymore. So you're living in a much more complicated world.
That's true, yeah. Now, I've been talking about going on the peak of the oscillation to help alleviate some of the problems with these parameter degeneracies. And you might talk, what about the higher peaks, 3 pi over 2, 5 pi over 2? And it turns out that as you go to the higher peaks, these coefficients that I talked about, the b-bar coefficient tends to approach the b coefficient, and likewise for the c-bar goes to the c as n increases. And this leads to actually a loss. Since the difference between the barred and the unbarred coefficients is your matter effect, which gives you your ability to determine the sine of delta m squared, this actually leads to a loss of sensitivity to the sine of delta m squared for larger values of n, the higher peaks. And that's shown here. This shows the sine squared 2 theta 1 3 reach for having no overlap between the two different sines of delta m squared in your probability space. And you can see for the first peak, and this is versus L here, for the first peak, if you go out to long enough L, then you can probe fairly down into theta 1 3 and still determine whether delta m squared is positive or negative. If you're on the second peak, really you can't go very low at all. This is above the current upper limit. And so the first peak is very good for determining the sine of delta m squared, but the second peak is not. And you can see that in a different way here, comparing the first and second peak in these probability diagrams. For the first peak, here what I've done is I've plotted sort of a range of theta 1-3 is increasing as I go along here. Delta varies over its range as you go across here. And you can see that the positive delta m squared, negative delta m squared, and this is for L of 2,540 kilometers, are very well separated for long distances. And so you'll know if you're here or here very easily. So you get good sensitivity to the sine of delta m squared. When you're on the second peak, the plot looks something like this, and you can see that the positive and negative delta m squareds are overlapping by quite a bit. And so you lose your sensitivity to the sine of delta m squared on the second peak, However, you also notice that the CP violation sensitivity, which is the width across here, is much higher than here than it was here where it was narrower. So the different peaks have their different strengths and weaknesses. Okay. So I'm going to talk about some other possibilities that have been discussed for measuring neutrino parameters. They're sort of listed on this page. So far, I've mainly talked just about narrowband measurements that are done, and basically it's a counting experiment. You just measure the rates in each channel. There is some spectrum information even in a narrow beam, and that can help resolve the degeneracies at least for larger values of theta 1.3, maybe 0.6 to 0.8, or 0.06 to 0.08 or higher. And of course also a neutrino factory has energy information as well as a much higher flux, and that can help resolve these degeneracies, and Steve Geer will talk about neutrino factory after lunch. There's also been studies about combining superbeam results with the neutrino factory data, which can help resolve degeneracies. Another thing you can do is look at nu e to nu tau to neutrino factory. Nu e to nu tau has a different CP phase dependence than nu e to nu mu, or nu mu to nu e. And also it has a different theta 2-3 dependence. And so it can help with both of these degeneracies here. Another thing you can try to think about is to do a single wideband neutrino beam. And if you're ever able to measure the neutrino energy well enough, then essentially what you're doing, if you can bin your events, is to make many measurements at different energies, which is like making, you know, 3, 4, 5 or more individual measurements, which may be enough then to help resolve some of these degeneracies. Now, in some cases, you may need to supplement the neutrino beam with an anti-neutrino beam, especially for the negative values of delta M squared, where the neutrino beam is somewhat, or the neutrino oscillations are somewhat suppressed. And here, of course, it's very important to have good energy resolution so you can actually do this binning efficiently. And you also, because you have a broadband beam, you have a lot of background problems as well. So your background discrimination here is essential. And this will be discussed later today, I think, also. And then another idea is to look at just the neutrino probabilities for two different experiments. This is, I guess, discussed yesterday. And I just have a sort of a brief plot of what that might look like, which you've probably seen something like it yesterday. Here, if you look at the positive delta M squared and negative delta M squared results in this probability space, you can see the positive delta M squareds define this narrow ray here, and the negative delta M squareds define this one. And here, notice each line here is an increasing value of theta 1.3. So here's sine squared 2 theta 1.3 of 0.01, 0.02, 0.03, this is 0.1. And delta is varying from pi over 2 to 3 pi over 2 as you go along the line. But you can see the 0.1 overlaps the 0.09, which overlaps the 0.08, et cetera. And in fact, in this region, you can get almost a factor of 2 uncertainty between, between the two different values of theta 1.3 that kind of lie on the same point. And they also have very different values of delta. Okay, and here I've also thrown in, assuming just a normal, with the original luminosities of JHF and NUMI, what the anticipated 3 sigma uncertainties might be, with sort of the same assumptions that I made before, and that is given by these curves here. And so you can see with these error bars, you can just barely differentiate, say, this point from this other line when sine squared 2 theta 1.3 is 0.08. Now, if you upgrade the luminosities to the upgraded versions here, then you can probably go down to about 0.04 before they start overlapping. So you can make some sort of sine of delta M squared determination, although you're limited somewhat by the statistics. And you can also look at perhaps the neutrino probability of JHF versus the anti-neutrino probability of NUMI. And this has, I think, a lot of characteristics similar to just P versus P bar at a single machine. So it's not necessarily fundamentally different. Okay, so what does all this mean? Well, to summarize, I would say that any two narrowband appearance measurements generally are not enough to completely determine delta and theta 1.3. they all leave some sort of degeneracy behind. And you can certainly do things experimentally to get rid of as many of the degeneracies as possible, but you're always going to have something left over. And antineutrino versus neutrino probability on the peak at a long enough L can determine the sine of delta M squared if theta 1,3 is not too small. It also then should give an unambiguous test of whether you have CP violation or not, and maybe the size of the CP violation. And it will give an unambiguous measurement of theta 1,3 if you're at the preferred value of theta 2,3. So that's not too bad. You can look at two different neutrino probabilities, say for different experiments, and this does separate the two signs of delta M squared, but you have a large uncertainty in delta and theta 1,3. And the next possibility might be to have neutrino versus antineutrino at two different values of L. And this can also determine the sine of delta M squared, even though these two values of L may not be as long as they were up here, assuming theta 1,3 is not too small. And the nice feature about this is that the combined experiments are less bothered by a large value of the solar delta M squared, whereas a single neutrino and antineutrino measurement at a longer L might have a problem if delta M squared solar was large. And then a wideband beam offers a theoretical possibility of determining all of these things, assuming theta 2,3 is pi over 4. However, you must have good energy resolution and control of your backgrounds. And the delta, pi minus delta, and the theta 2,3 ambiguities do not significantly interfere with CP violation tests, whether you have CP violation or not. And so if you had to give up something, then maybe these are the things to try to give up and maybe leave them for additional measurements later. However, you might still have a theta 1,3 uncertainty if theta 2,3 is not at pi over 4. And the best way to resolve the theta 2,3 ambiguity, if it does exist, is probably via nu e to nu tau at a neutrino factory. Okay, thank you. All of our studies were JHF on the peak, and then we let NUMI be all over. That's what we looked at. Because it seemed like that was pretty well set in stone, but certainly you could do that. And yeah.
I suggest you try.
Have you done that?
Well, not with the same statistical detail that you've done, but in the biprobability plots, you get some quite nice separation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's probably worth looking at, to just look at all the possibilities.
The experiment that has the larger matter effect can be lower energy in terms of where it is in the oscillation. Mm-hmm. And the one that has the less matter effect could be higher energy. Mm-hmm. And I think if you, with that, you can do three experiments and determine what we can do. But as you point out, I'm not sure that I can persuade my Japanese colleagues.
You want them to run higher energy?
Yeah.
So they're before the peak.
Yeah.
They come in before the peak.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, I think it might be worth looking at more possibilities just to see what's out there.
The trouble with going off the energy is that the background is so optimal to join off the background. So you have a
bit of penalty. Well, it's not an enormous increase.
Of course, the statistics go up quite a bit because that higher energy is, particularly for the antineutrinos, the cross section spectrometry is steeply rising with energy in the antineutrinos.
Yeah, I just wanted to confirm the Majorana phase is completely canceled out. The two extra phases.
Yeah, the oscillations only determine one phase. Right.
Mm-hmm. And the other two phases.
They're unmeasurable. Yeah.
Unmeasurable.
In neutrino oscillations. Yeah. Well. Yeah, certainly. And I've been talking about perhaps in the long run getting a complete determination of the neutrino mass matrix. And of course, there you need absolute masses. And you need those additional phases if it's Majorana. And so certainly.
The absolute masses are a much more burning question than the Majorana phases. And you can't determine that in oscillation either.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Notice that there's sort of a contrast between this morning and this talk in terms of the time scales for these experiments and how definitive the results are. We heard this morning about how quickly CanMax came online. It's a relatively cheap experiment. It really did great shipping. We saw what will happen when the snow results get more precise, which is how quickly they're going to narrow the parameters on the solar region. But this is a difficult experiment. It requires multiple measurements and upgraded beams. Mm-hmm. Probably 10 years of work.
Yes.
And we also heard from Steve's discussion yesterday the possibility of high energy physics going after, really super beam where you get to 10 to the minus 4 and measure CP violations with great precision. So I'm sort of a bit puzzled by why the high energy community is thinking about a 10-year program to do physics that may not be that definitive or that important when it's done, when maybe you should be going after something much more ambitious.
Well, I think probably will work at this in stages, and so you might want to have a beginning program, and maybe it may not be with the beam upgrades. Maybe it'll just be without the upgrades at maybe one or two sites, and then eventually work your way maybe even to a neutrino factory in the end. So I mean, hopefully you would have sort of a progression of one leading to another, and it may not just be exactly this scenario. It may be a non-upgraded version of this. Isn't a possibility.
Would you envision actually spending a decade doing this and then thinking about going on to the next step?
Possibly. That's you might ask Steve Geer more about the.
I think if we had the technology to build a neutrino factory right now, and we had the dollars to do it, then we wouldn't be discussing these intermediate steps. But there's a number of years of R&D that we need to do before you could propose and build a neutrino factory. And one of the elements of a neutrino factory is an intense, very intense photo source, which is the thing that one needs for these ambitious superbeams. So there is room and motivation to do the superbeams and try and implement the intense photo source and climb up the learning curve. And then, when that program delivers results in 10 to 15 years' time, you would be ready at that point to begin building a neutrino factory. That's the solar
picture.
So
we've
well past my retirement.
Do you know if measuring CP violation of electron damage is an interesting thing to do and a major piece of business?
I think it's interesting, but the gamble here is how big that one is.
Well, if we.
And again, it's a long time, right? So what if somebody shows that they can do a reactor experiment in the next 3 years, it's going to get to be on 2001. How do you know that the next step should be on that, not 2005?
Nobody can see CP violation on a reactor experiment.
With the field moving so quickly, I think it's hard to think about a big investment that takes 10 years gestation periods.
Well, some of them do theta 1-3 for 3 years. That's for sure.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Are there any more questions?
Actually, I might mention, you can actually, in these long baseline experiments, even if theta 1-3 is zero, in principle, you can see events from the secondary oscillation, the solar oscillation. There might not be CP violation measurable, but you can actually add, an additional measurement of the solar oscillation just from these experiments.
Yeah.